I'm Don Weitz, psychiatric survivor of 110 insulin shock treatments many years ago. I'm glad I survived. Some of my brothers and sisters didn't. And an anti-psychiatry activist. And I'll brief, and which means I'm totally against the psychiatric system. As some of you may have heard me give this little spiel or explanation during the first lecture in September, when I gave you the reasons, some of the reasons why I and a few others, and I wish there were more, took an anti-psychiatry position. Like many others, I was locked up. That was many years ago in 1952, 53 in Massachusetts. And it took me many years to understand that I should never have been locked up to begin with, like many others, but should have been able to stay in the community and get some community support, which there was very little of at that time. That was in Boston. And I can say to this day, in Canada, in the United States, we don't have nearly enough alternatives, and that's the subject of my speech, alternatives to psychiatry. Psychiatry seems to be the choice of many people. It is not my choice, and one of the main reasons it is not my choice, because it really doesn't help or help people heal. It humiliates, it disempowers people, takes away their power. It uses the use of force authorized by the state, which other doctors do not resort to, only psychiatrists. And it often permanently harms people. The oath that doctors to be, take, is an old Greek oath saying, first do no harm. First do no harm. And psychiatry does that. It violates that oath. Every time a psychiatrist gives you a drug against your will, every time a psychiatrist locks you up under the name of involuntary committal, which is a euphemism for psychiatric imprisonment. The word imprisonment should be used, not committal, because you're locked up. And without a trial, usually, without charge, without a witness as an advocate, when you're alone in the admission department, very often, people don't know, not aware of the fact that they can have a friend or advocate with them as a witness, and many others don't, because very often when people end up in the psychiatric ward, they are dragged, I shouldn't say physically dragged, but they're taken there against their will, often by the police and even by some well-meaning family relatives. My family cooperated with the psychiatrist to get me locked up. And the correct word for that is collusion. So although some people might want to use the word conspiring, but God forbid that I will be labeled paranoid if I use that term. I'm going to be talking about alternatives to this so-called mental health system, to psychiatry in particular. Free at last! Free at last! Thank God Almighty we are free at last. Who said that? Martin Luther King, exactly. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will live as one. Exactly. And that's what is in the beginning of my paper. Imagine that we don't, people, our friends, our relatives, our loved ones, don't have to go into the psychiatric system to get help. There have always been alternatives to psychiatric treatments. There just aren't enough of them. Not enough variety. That's largely because mental health professionals, the public, and the media have been so indoctrinated into psychiatry's medical model that most can't imagine, they can't imagine any non-medical survivor-run alternatives for people going through a crisis. This is a form, to be very mild, of tunnel vision. You only see one, go down one track, but you can't see or are not aware of other alternatives outside of your narrow vision. And psychiatry has a very narrow vision. I'm particularly thinking of biological psychiatry, which seems to be, has been in power for the last 40 to 50 years, unfortunately. Now, imagine a world without psychiatry. Imagine a world where there are no phony, fraudulent psychiatric labels that stigmatize, marginalize, demonize, and dehumanize people. Imagine a world where there are no mental health centers, youth assessment and detention centers, maximum security forensic units, and seclusion, solitary confinement, rooms that institutionalize and traumatize vulnerable human beings. Imagine a world where children, teenagers, adults, and elderly people going through their own crisis or living hells are not locked up, not forcibly drugged, not electroshocked, not lobotomized, not physically restrained, not threatened with psychiatric hospitalization, involuntary committal. Imagine that. Imagine a world where a young person's existential identity crisis, spiritual crisis, or severe emotional stress is not psychiatrically labeled bipolar, ADHD, schizophrenia, borderline personality, and all the other bullshit, if I may use that term, a non-medical term, all these made-up pseudo-medical labels. Imagine a world where instead they are able to ask for, people are able to ask for and receive emotional, social, and economic support in their own communities and neighborhoods without feeling ashamed or apologetic and without being criminalized or stigmatized. Imagine a world where people who act or sound weird or nonconformist, which I plead guilty to, are not patronized, are not ostracized or discriminated against, but treated as human beings with dignity and respect that each and every one of us deserves for the very reason we're human. That's enough. Imagine a world where the human rights of every person are universally respected, affirmed, and protected. So what might it be like to live in a psychiatry-free world, you may ask? Well, with the mental health system gone, just imagine that, a costly and useless layer of bureaucracy would be eliminated. With the deletion of mental health laws and regulations, there would be no more authorization for incarcerating, locking up, innocent people in psychiatric facilities, especially locked wards and seclusion rooms, where they are routinely degraded, humiliated, forcibly treated, and denied many human rights. This, in a psychiatry-free world, there would be no CTOs, community treatment orders, which are the law in at least 5 or 6 provinces and over 32 or 3 states where they can forcibly drug you after you're released in the community and even pressure you to take drugs in your own home. There have been a number of outrageous examples of this, particularly in the United States, and I'm sure many here in Toronto and other cities where people have been drugged against their will in their own homes, own apartments, own the rooms. And there would be, in a psychiatry-free world, the abolition of maximum security forensic units that would mean that offenders could no longer be locked up in an extremely restrictive, brutal, and dehumanizing prisons. In a psychiatry-free world, we would finally see the end of consent and capacity boards and mental health review boards, which I've witnessed, unfortunately, these which are psychiatrically biased tribunals that are actually nothing but kangaroo courts, where psychiatrists' clinical judgment invariably trumps the inmates' or prisoners' appeals for freedom, choice, personal autonomy, and other human rights. In a psychiatry-free world, labels such as schizophrenia, psychopathic personality, sociopath, bipolar, borderline, ADHD, could no longer be used to diagnose people. The very utterance of such pejorative, stigmatizing terms in the public would be judged and punished as a form of hate speech or hate crime. At least that's what I think. And in a psychiatry-free world, without a mental health, no psychiatrist would have the power to diagnose, lock up, forcibly drug, electroshock, or lobotomize people in crisis, or to judge people as incompetent or incapable, which they are now. Psychiatrists have no training. And in a psychiatry-free world, no psychiatrist would have expert witness status in any legal proceedings. In a psychiatry-free world, all psychiatric facilities could be converted into affordable housing, including co-ops and safe houses, as well as drug withdrawal centers and crisis centers. Now, I'm going to mention some alternatives that exist. Unfortunately, this is just a small sample, so please don't interpret what I'm saying as well as these are all the alternatives there are. I'm sure I will leave some out. Some of you probably already know them, some alternatives that I have missed, so we can get into that during the discussion. Non-coercive, community-based alternatives to the psychiatric system. Most of the existing ones are controlled by psychiatric survivors, others by partnerships between survivors and supportive health workers. These resources provide help and relief for people trying to overcome a personal crisis or recover from psychiatry's so-called safe and effective treatments. Sadly, as I said at the beginning, there are too few alternatives to allow many people to avoid psychiatric hospitalization and treatment, too few to assist us in reclaiming our lives. Let me tell you a personal story that got me interested, not just interested, but active in setting up the first survivor-controlled self-help group in Ontario on our own in 1977, although it was we first named the group Ontario Mental Patients Association, and you'll see why. I got together with Harvey Jackson, a very dear and close friend who died some years ago, and Bob Carson, both of them, like myself, psychiatric survivors, and we looked around Ontario, to Toronto. This was in 1977, over 35 years ago, my God, 40 years. And we said, where is there a place where people like us can just get together and say whatever the hell we feel like doing? Well, just talk, rap, you know, just among ourselves, place where we can feel safe. We went to I took a trip out to Vancouver because I heard of the Mental Patients Association, which still exists, but it's mainly controlled now by a mix of social workers and psychiatric survivors. That was the first in Canada, MPA. And there's a video about it too. I'm sorry, please come on in. And I stayed in one of their houses. At that time, MPA had a crisis center, a drop-in, and it was really, at that time, pretty chaotic, as you can imagine. That was the only one in Vancouver, and everybody with so many people who were coming out or felt they had to go into the psychiatric hospital would go to MPA because they knew they would be accepted. Where there were no drugs, where people weren't drugged or threatened. And I stayed in one of the houses for 10 days and watched democracy, real democracy in action, where people like the Occupy movement, where people could say what they wanted, could respect each other's point of view, and made their own decisions. The psychiatrists weren't around, there were no health professionals around to make decisions for them. So this was a very empowering thing, and I said, my God, there's got to be something like that in Toronto. So when I went back, as I said, I got together with Harvey Jackson and Bob Carson, and we approached Reverend Norman Ellis. At the time, he was head of the church, All Saints Church, an Anglican church at Sherbourne and Dundas, which still exists. And we said, can we have some space just to hold for people to get together a few times a week? And he was very kind and considerate. He said, sure. And he didn't charge us anything. He says, when you can pay, you can pay. You can pay the church when you can afford it. I didn't think we could afford it. Anyway, that's where we met. And that was the birth of the first self-help group where people could come in two or three times a week, have coffee for 25 cents, and there was a feeling, you know, where people could make some friends and no one kicked you out, although we did have some rules. And the only rule we had, one of the two rules we had, was there would be no alcohol in the meeting and no violence. And people stuck to that, and that was quite reasonable. So On Our Own was the first self-help support group, and that was in 1977. And since that time, there have been a number of drop-ins. But let me give you some characteristics of On Our Own. And that title is the title of Judy Chamberlain's classic movement classic called On Our Own, where she called On Our Own patient-controlled alternatives to the mental health system. We originally called ourselves Ontario Mental Patient Association because we were inspired. I was inspired, and I got others interested in having something like the mental, like MPA in Toronto. So we called ourselves Ontario Mental Patient Association, and two or three years later, we called ourselves On Our Own to emphasize that we wanted to be independent and we weren't beholden to anybody, and we didn't have any government funding, no money from the government for the first 2.5 years. And we raised our own money by picking up stuff in Rosedale and other places where people would throw out as garbage good appliances and stuff and all kinds of knickknacks, and we take them up to a flea market booth at King and Lawrence and sell them. In 2 years, Through volunteer labor, we made $15,000 working only on the weekends. And this was such, and that was Harvey Jackson's idea. Now that's a success story, yes. And we don't hear enough of these success stories of our that we have been a part of. It's about time that the media started, instead of calling us, oh, mentally ill, and you gotta watch out for these people, they're scary, blah, blah, blah. But people, when they come together and decide on a course of action, they can really do amazing things. And we made money for ourselves, and then we eventually got a grant. Now, what did on our own, we had the first drop-in, okay, in Toronto and probably Ontario, where everybody was welcome. Anybody who self-identified as a survivor. There was a sense of belonging, people, and that's crucial. You want to set up a group, you have to get, you have to arrange it so people feel that they belong. They're not an outsider. They matter. You're not a statistic, the way the governments would like us to think of each other. You're not a case, human being. Then we put out a newsletter to talk about what each other's were doing. And we later set up computer training for people who are interested and want to learn how to do a computer. This was about in the late 80s. I was not involved because I'm virtually illiterate when it comes to computers and high tech. So I can't say, I can't take any credit for that, but I could. But we had monthly meetings, and we set up the first used goods store called the Mad Market, which has been used by some. I guess there's other places called the Mad Market. We had the first one, 1980 to 1996. First we had one at Queen near Bathurst, and then we moved it to Queen and Woodbine. And people who thought that they were very shy or didn't want to deal with the public, didn't have any business skills, learned from each other. People shared what they knew. It was real sharing, and that was exciting. And then we got a grant and so forth, because we proved to the government that we could, that we were responsible, and we were helping each other. Now, another group that exists today is Sound Times, and I hope somebody is, anybody here from Sound Times? You are wonderful. So maybe you can tell us more about it, because I just want to mention it in passing. Well, I will say a few things about Sound Times. It's at a Parliament in Dundas, right? And maybe during the discussion you want to get. But Sound Times, I'll just... has, I believe, over 400 members. It's, I think, one of the close to being the largest support group for psychiatric survivors in Ontario. Now, I may be wrong. That started in 1992. It's, and like On Our Own, Sound Times is totally controlled by psychiatric survivors. And I'm very partial to seeing psychiatric survivors be in complete control of their own services. Louise?
I can't help but express my shock. You're saying that psychiatric patients can have peer support group without... I thought it was illegal.
What? What's illegal?
To have peer support.
No, it's absolutely legal.
Don't staff people around. It just,
it's absolutely legal. We can get into this. Yeah,
okay, we can.
No,
you're
no,
shocking
no.
Me, because I've never known there
peer
was such
support.
I didn't know there was such a thing.
Well, there are lots. Okay. There are a number of peer support groups. That's just the fancy name, peer support, for people getting together and helping each other, sharing what they know. That's what it means. We could set up a peer support here, anywhere you want. It's about people who share a particular condition. Or a particular disability or whatever, just getting together and, as I said, sharing what they know and empowering each other. And that is a worldwide movement, yes, in virtually every country in the West, and I'm sure many in Asia and South America, but I didn't want to get, but I'm coming back to Sound Times, and please, please correct me if I'm wrong. Sorry, I should know your name.
Anu,
yes, if I'm wrong about this, that Sound Times helps members find affordable housing and apply for and receive financial aid, welfare, ODSP, helps people get that, provides free food and clothing, computer training, legal advice, and advocacy. That's an awful lot. And this is a group that is doing it now and has been doing it for over 20 years. Am I wrong?
Yeah, they have their own space, and they also run a lot of recreational programming.
Yeah, she just said running a lot of recreational. So let's hold off, but thank you for reminding. Maybe you can add to that during the discussion. One of its recent outreach projects, I got this off the computer, is providing educational material and legal support in a class action lawsuit regarding the neuroleptic Zyprexa. So many people have been hurt, not just in Toronto, but by this very powerful drug. And apparently there's a lawsuit brewing. And I would like to know more about this. And I've left word with Lana Fredo, who is the executive director of Sound Times. Another major support that you should be aware of that's been going successfully here in Toronto since 1980, 3 years after On Our Own started, is PARC, Parkdale Activity and Recreation Center. Bonnie knows about this quite a bit, and we bump into each other there quite a bit, eh, Bonnie? This drop-in social agency was founded by a handful. See, it doesn't take many, just a few psychiatric survivors and community worker activists who wanted to create community support for the many survivors living in Parkdale neighborhood. It's in Toronto's West End, for those of you who don't know. In the wake of the failure of deinstitutionalization, hundreds were and still are homeless, unemployed, poor, and forced to survive on minimal financial aid, such as welfare, family benefits, I always put that in quotes, it's not so much of a benefit, or disability allowance. PARC employs a mix of community workers and survivors. Its constitution mandates that a minimum of 50% of the board of directors must be psychiatric survivors. Now, here are the things that PARC provides. And Bonnie or somebody else who's been to PARC, please correct me if I've left something out. Emergency housing and shelter referral and assistance. Emergency food support, as well as daily meals. You can go into PARC and you won't go away hungry. There is always a big kitchen there and plentiful food, at least the times I've been there. Emergency supplies for helping people stay warm in the winter. Well, I'm sure they would appreciate that if they don't have enough clothing. Anybody that has a spare clothing, heavy clothing. Free showers, clothing, and laundry facilities, a warm place to sit, people to talk to, internet access, as well as computer assistance and training provided by members, volunteer support, transportation assistance. I'm sure they give out tokens, TTC probably, or used to. I don't know.
I have a message about them.
Huh?
But they also have live music there on Wednesday morning.
And live music when?
On Wednesday morning from about 10 to about 1.
Thank you, yes.
They have housing upstairs, and they've just opened Edmonton.
Thank you very much for that. We can get in. Art and art supply subsidies, outings to local cinema, so forth. PARC workers are strong advocates of affordable housing and supporters of anti-poverty initiative. One of the organization's current housing projects is the Edmund U. Place at Queen and the cross street. It's just before you get to Roncesvalles.
East of Park. It's a couple of doors east of Park.
A couple doors east?
On the same side. I forget the name. Of the
yeah, street. East of Park. Anyway, it's near Lonsdale, I think. This is a resident-controlled house named after Edmund Waihong Yu, who was shot by the police on a deserted TTC bus in 1997. Anyway, and it's funded, the park is funded by city, provincial, and federal governments. And in Edmund Yu Place, there are 29 self-contained bachelor units, I believe. Am I wrong?
Yeah, they also have, they go camping every summer.
Camping every summer. But am I wrong about the units?
I'm not sure.
The bachelor units. Okay.
Park offers legal support for people on ODSP.
Park offers legal support, thank you, Mark. And?
For people on ODSP.
For people on ODSP, so that's important. Now I want to get into something we do not have, and it really bothers the hell out of me why Toronto, one of the richest and most diverse cities in Canada, does not have for psychiatric survivors an independent, freestanding drug withdrawal center. I'm not talking about street drugs here. I'm talking about prescribed psychiatric drugs that many people are on, often by choice, but many people are being given them against their will, and they're having bad effects. Damn bad effects. And the doctors who prescribe these drugs are not informing people of the risks. And to me, that's criminal. When a doctor prescribes a medicine or anything, he or she is by law required to follow the principle of informed consent, which means before asking you to agree to take a pill, whether it's aspirin or Zyprexa, you have to know the major effects and which are called side effects, but I call them direct effects, and the risks, and alternatives, and alternatives. I have never met, maybe I met one person, but I can't recall who that is, when I said, did the doctor tell you about Paxil? Did the doctor tell you about Zyprexa? What did he say? Nothing. Nothing. But in medicine, a medical doctor generally does. Whether you're going to go into surgery, you certainly, most of the time, and I can speak personally, when I was going into surgery, I was told about the effects and what would happen if I didn't go. You know, it happened to be my heart. So at least the doctors, medical doctors, seem to be more observant of to follow the informed consent, but not the psychiatrist. And I'd like to sue the bastards, the psychiatrists, who don't tell you a damn thing before prescribing these mind-altering drugs. So what we need is, I'm saying, a place, more than one place, where people who are on drugs, antidepressants, so-called antipsychotics, neuroleptics, you name it, any psychiatric drugs, can go by choice, by their own decision, not forced, to come off psychiatric drugs, knowing that there are people there like themselves who've been through it, who have kicked the habit, so to speak, and many psychiatric drugs, as many of you know, are habit-forming or addictive, so it's very hard to come off them. Very hard, and we can get into that some other. But we have no place like that here in Toronto, and I think that's a damn shame. We have Insight in Vancouver, which is coming to Toronto, where people who are on hard drugs like cocaine and heroin can come off and even inject themselves in the process of lowering the dose. And by the way, as I mentioned during the last lecture, if you're on a psychiatric drug, friends, and you know somebody who is, please, please make sure that you or the person you're trying to help comes off gradually, step by step. because cold turkey suddenly stopping it will make you feel like you're going crazy again. Yes, because it's happened, and you end up again in the psych ward.
The doctor took them off.
Yes.
And I know what it
is. And many, yes, I'm sure you do. Yes, Kevin, very quickly.
I believe it's called a washout period.
Sorry, washout.
It's called a washout.
Well, it does take time for the drug to come out of your system.
I'm just saying the language is interesting. It's detox for drugs,
taper off, taper.
But for psychiatry meds, it's washout. It sounds nicer.
Okay.
It's just as bad.
All right, washout. All right, sorry. All right.
Washout is the time when you're switching from one drug to another.
You're switching from one drug to the other.
First drug.
All right. Yeah. So we. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. I learn something every time. No, but can we continue? I just want to say, there is an urgent need. This is not a side issue. I haven't heard. Okay. Let me give you an example. 1990, Bonnie Burbursto, a good friend who is chair of the Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault, she and I wrote a paper. We delivered it to the Toronto Board of Health at an open public meeting. And we said, look, this is 1990, okay? We said, look, there's a need for public education. You guys are the experts, or you, some of them, on the Board of Health, to educate. So educate people about psychiatric drugs. Help set up a withdrawal center. Silence. Nothing happened. And to this day, neither the Toronto Board of Health nor City Council, of course I don't expect any good thing to come out of the Ford Council, has gotten behind an effort to set up this desperately, urgently needed place for people to come off psychiatric drugs, because you know what? The public, the media, and many doctors who prescribe you the drugs say, oh, well, you got to stay on the drugs for the rest of your life. That's a lie. That's a bald-faced lie. Nobody needs to take a drug. I'm talking about psychiatric drugs. I'm not talking about any other. For the rest of your life, you have to take an antidepressant. And that's how people get hooked, because the prescribing doctor has this tunnel vision idea, or this real crazy idea that because you are on a tranquilizer that, or particularly an antidepressant for your depression or whatever he diagnosed, you've got to stay on it. Anyway, I'm going to skip to another alternative. Anyway, so those of you who are in touch with doctors who have open minds and who haven't made up their mind about psychiatric survivors and who may be questioning the term mental illness, could may pop that question to them. Doctor, would you be speaking out in favor of drug withdrawal centers? I haven't heard any because the silence of the medical profession of psychiatric drug withdrawal centers is deafening. We need a healing house for people who've had electroshock. I was chairing a panel discussion, and mine knows about this. In 2005, we had the only public hearing at City Hall on electroshock. It takes a lot of courage for people to come forward to talk about this. And there were three or four of us. I was on a panel with a bunch of professionals, and we wrote a report based on the testimony. And one of the things that the panel agreed to was yes. And what we heard was that women in particular, because 2 to 3 times more women than men are electroshocked. I don't know whether you know that statistics, but you won't find that in the Toronto Star or the Globe and Mail or the CBC. Anyway, women, we heard from at least two, said, I wish there was a place where I could go to learn some skills that shock had erased. And we have none. I haven't heard of a healing center for shock survivors. If anybody has, please speak up. And especially during our discussion, but that's something that can be done. That's not That's not rocket science. It's not rocket science to set up a drug withdrawal center. It's doable. You get people together. You get doctors and nurses who believe in you, especially survivors like ourselves who've suffered a lot, and say, listen, we're going to get something, do something constructive, because you, the city fathers and sisters, you have not paid enough attention to us and are disrespecting us, and we're not going to take it anymore, and we're going to get something together. You have to get together in a group in your own home or apartment. That's how On Our Own got started. That's how some of the great inventions or some of the great alternatives have started. Just people like yourselves getting together and say, look, we're fed up. I'm tired of seeing my mother or father or sister going into an institution and coming out worse. Where's the alternative? Not enough. So we need a healing place, and let me describe you for you what I have in mind. I already mentioned, and the drug withdrawal center, I should say, should have backup with a GP, because in case people are having a bad medical reaction when they come off, even gradually, you do need sometimes medical backup for good advice and for a doctor who supports the withdrawal center to be on hand, to be on call. I don't think that's too much to expect, Burleigh. Now, here's what I had in mind for a healing house, which would be mainly at this point for shock survivors who have lost some skills, and mainly for women, by women, controlled by women, because the statistics we know now is that proportionally more women than men are electroshock. I have statistics for Vancouver and Toronto, it shows clearly 2 to 3 times more women than men are being zapped with electricity, which can erase not just memories, but skills. My closest woman friend used to be a super bright. She has a master's in mathematics and could play a Beethoven sonata. After shock, 15 shock treatments, she cannot remember the musical notes to play, and she claims she's become less smart. Women could get together if they chose to start a house, to set up a house, to help people, women like themselves, their sisters, to reclaim their identity and reclaim their skills. I know a woman who couldn't write a sentence, finally hard to write a sentence after shock, and she's an artist and had trouble painting. Fortunately, now she is. Above all, what time do we have? Is it close to 8?
It's 10 to 8.
I'm going to go very fast and try to shut up in about 5 or 10 minutes and allow you to take over, allow you to come
over. Between...
Yeah, well, we have to have a break.
Yeah.
We could close every psychiatric institution in this province if we chose to. You know how? By the provincial governments getting behind an initiative to phase out, not all at once necessarily, phase out like they did in institutions for the people with developmental disabilities. Thank you, Louise. Phase out all psychiatric institutions and replace them with housing. This is not rocket science. This is not a radical idea, but apparently is. Think the millions of dollars, not to mention lives, human lives. It could be saved by having supportive housing, safe housing, co-ops, where people could, in your own community, where people could go when they're freaking out or feel that they're freaking out, where you're feeling very down or depressed for good reason, you lost your job or something, or you broke up a relationship, and understandably, you're going through a crisis. But it's not a disease. It's not a mental illness. This is human. Everybody goes through crisis. Everybody in this room, I'm sure, has gone through a crisis or knows somebody. And if you haven't gone through a personal crisis, you will. The point is that we're not providing enough non-medical community-based places for people to feel it's okay. It's okay. We're here for you. We're here for you. We're here with you. Soteria, which is the Greek name for deliverance, this is a house. I wish we had it here. This is a type of supportive housing that was initiated by Dr. Lauren Mosher, M-O-S-H-E-R. And I urge you, and his book or two books by him are in the public library. A very humane guy. He gave a lecture. He talked at York a few years ago before he died. He set up a place in California, and they have one in Bern, Switzerland now, Soteria, a place for 10 people to stay, not indefinitely, where people who have been labeled schizophrenic at the beginning phase, so to speak, could go, and no one would give you drugs, but if you wanted drugs, you could take them. But the idea was that people could come off drugs, and at the end of 6 to 8 weeks, or maybe a bit more, over 50% of the people in this house were not on drugs, and there were independent testing done comparing the people who were in a psychiatric ward and those were in Soteria on a number of measures. And the people in the Soteria house scored higher, like being having more social abilities, being more open and just in better shape than the people who were in the psychiatric ward, where you are forcibly drugged as a matter of course. There was no forced drugging in, and there is never forced drugging in any place like Soteria. So I wish we had places like that. And I'll finish up just a bit by talking about this, a Hearing Voices network. There are many people who hear voices. And if you tell a psychiatrist, oh, I hear a voice, right away, oh, well, he's schizophrenic, I'm going to give him a drug, and so forth and so on. That's the worst thing you can do. This Hearing Voices network was pioneered in Europe, in Holland, and it spread to Portugal, Spain, and Denmark, and Norway. There are groups now of people who hear voices getting together, and so that many times that the voices stop. Now, how is that possible? It stopped by a dynamic social process of people listening, understanding, not judging the other person, and respecting the other person. I haven't heard of a Hearing Voices network, although there was a Hearing Voices group. I understand at Sound Times, I may be wrong. I know a very, very close friend who has tried to set up a Hearing Voices group, but I wish there were more. It's not a symptom of mental illness to hear voices. This is the message that's coming out of the network, which consists of psychiatrists, dissident psychiatrists. It's not a symptom. It's a very human thing, like being down or depressed. It's a crisis. It can be a crisis if the voices get very, very accusatory and commanding. No one minimizes that. But I'm saying to you that it's not a symptom of anything. It is can be a disturbing event in the person's life, and if it's so disturbing, then why shouldn't we have groups for people to share their pain, or not pain, but their distress? And I think one of the biggest problems why we don't have enough alternatives is that the psychiatrists who have so much power medicalize so much of what is human. And that's why, and they are preventing in their own way the setting up of alternatives. The major thing is when people now, if they feel they're having a panic attack or too anxious, many end up in the emergency room, and that's one of the, or if they're suicidal, if they're having suicidal thoughts, their family or somebody takes them to St. Mike's or CAMH, where they're promptly drugged, and it suppresses. These drugs suppress the ideas, the disturbance that you're trying to understand and work through. Medicine should not be in the business of suppressing personal existential crisis, but with chemicals or electricity. We can do better. We have done better. There are alternatives. So I'll be quiet and we'll take a break, maybe 10 minutes, and come back and we can have a discussion. Okay? Is that okay? Thank you.